Accession number 20331, Reel 2.
That was where...
John Perkins, Reel 2. Carry on.
That's where I was up to, cleaning my own boots, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So, having done the 6 weeks basic training up there, it didn't come difficult at all. Mind you, we had the usual extra duties, fatigues, but by good fortune, I was asked by the platoon sergeant to blanco his webbing equipment. And he said, have you ever done it? I says, I'll try myself. Well, he said, try mine. Anyway, fair enough. And this was in my own time, you know, after parades. And I made a job of it. And he came in and said, not bad. And I never got any horrible fatigues. I always used to get into the sergeant's mess, cookhouse, or the officer's mess, where some of them got pushed onto coal heaving after church parade on a Sunday morning, you know. But anyway, having done my basic training up there, we was posted, when I say we, meaning the recruits that was assigned to the Middlesex Regiment, up onto the Isle of Anglesey. There must have been about 120 of us, I suppose. And we was up there from late March, or mid-March, because it's about mid-March, to the end of July, where we really done some very tough training. We started off in PE kit, you know, pimpsels and football shorts and a singlet vest. And by the time we finished, 13 weeks later, we was doing everything in full battle kit. And it was, involved route marches, and then we even done night training. This might sound stupid. We done night training with darkened goggles at the height of summer in the daytime. And we also done what the platoon sergeant used to call battle discipline. In other words, if he was running over the sand dunes and the sand dune had a steep drop of say 25 feet one side, you followed him. You jumped it or got down it some way. And if he went out up to his neck in the sea, because it was a coastal resort, you went out up to your neck in the sea. And he used to call it, he came from the Durham area, and he couldn't say discipline, he always just say discipline. And so we was up there for 13 weeks.
What was the name of the resort?
Ross Nigo. R-H-O-S-N, I think it's N-E-I-G-R. It's Welsh. And it's on the west coast of the island anyway. And we could look out over, the next mainland was Ireland. And then we got allotted to our different battalions throughout the different parts of the country. And I was posted to the 8th Battalion, the Middlesex Regiment, and then down at Margate in Kent.
What impression did they make on you?
What?
When you first joined the battalion?
Well, we found it all right, or I found it all right. The first night, they didn't seem to know what to do with us. And I remember sleeping under canvas in the grounds of what had been a children's home, I think. as it was known as Rob Roy's home. Whatever Rob Roy, I know Rob Roy is a history of Scotland, isn't it? But and then we, the following morning, we was allocated billets along the seafront, which was houses emptied out, you know, by the evacuation. And the battalion went on various exercises. Some were doing learning machine guns, some were learning the 4.2 mortar, and I was put onto a 20mm Oerlikon gun, which was mounted on a 1500 weight truck, flatback truck. And there was I think it was a crew of five in all. But we didn't do a wonderful lot. We was, you know, I mean, ammunition, to be honest, I never even fired live ammunition with it, or on it. But we was instructed on how to fill up the magazines and how to lift the complete gun off the back of the truck and insert wheels to make it like a small artillery piece. But the training, I didn't think the training prepared me anything for D-Day, not then. And we used to go out on these brigade or divisional exercises, but really, to be honest, I didn't know where I was going or what I was doing. We was all in convoy. We pulled up in a field dead of night or something, and the next morning you wake up and you move off again. And but the biggest exercise I ever went on, which had some meaning to me, was we went from Margate right the way down. I think it might have been the New Forest, and we was all under the trees down there, and this exercise was on waterproofing the vehicles, so that when they went into Normandy, or wherever, I mean, nobody wasn't even on anyone's mind then, you know, not the ordinary soldier, and protected the electrics on a, you know, like distributor, the spark plugs, and also the exhaust. The exhaust was extended up above the cab, you know, by flexible pipe, and a great deal of it looked like plasticine was used, you know, to wrap everything round where water was affected, and this was in the New Forest. So anyway, we was issued out with ration packs. We'd been in the New Forest about 3 or 4 days, and we had an early reveille. The next thing we knew, we was going down the roads of Southampton, and we boarded a landing craft. Not just us, I mean many landing craft. And in the afternoon, the following morning, we woke up and we couldn't see. When I say woke up, I mean we were sleeping as and where we could. We couldn't see a bit of land at all. And all of a sudden, it was just as if a regimental sergeant major and all of that about turned, and all these ships, and they, you know, there's 200 or 300 ships, all turned round. And we done this simulated landing along the Sussex coast. And we, the battalion, landed at East Wittwin in Sussex. And the idea of it was to, so we were told, to find out the effect of salt water on brake drums. And when we got back to Margate, for about a fortnight, every vehicle, you know, whether it was a motorcycle or brake gun carrier or 3-ton truck, It was on the road in the afternoon, and they'd done a certain amount of mileage, just to see the effect of salt water on brake drums, which it didn't seem to have any effect at the time. Whether it did or not later on, I don't know. But we used to do exercise. We did one exercise, and we was stuck out in the hop fields of Faversham in Kent. All the hop pickers were there. We had a life of O'Reilly there. I mean, the women used to cook our food for us because we were self-contained, you see. We never had to... each little group had its own ration allotment. So if there was five of us, I mean, that ration allotment was for that five. Anyway, we moved back into... Margate after the exercise, and of course that was the winter was coming on, and that was 1943. Then we moved to Crowborough on the Sussex-Kent border, but there was nothing exciting happened there because winter time, you see, and we was in a hutted camp there, and then just after Christmas of 1943, we moved back onto the south coast at Cherrington, just outside Folkestone, and we was in billets there. And when I say billets, empty houses taken over by the army. And the most useful thing I'd done, I suppose, was when we had to do guard duty at night on all the vehicles that were all parked along the road. And one of the best things that we used to do was, as a time waster, we used to get into the local phone box and dial O and speak to the female telephone operator. Anyway, one boy, and then this was... must have been March, late March. I was told I was being posted to the Royal Hampshire Regiment, or the Hampshire Regiment as it was in those days, which was at Cruden Beach, Bexhill. And the reason was the 20mm Oerlikon guns, they were surplus to requirements of the... of the army, by then the Allies had got air supremacy, and it was deemed that they weren't useful as a ground attack weapon. So we all got made redundant as regards the using Oerlikon guns. And I was shoved over to the Hampshire Regiment.
Which and battalion was that?
Pardon?
Which battalion?
7th Battalion. And hadn't been there long. And got posted again back to Hythe in Kent to what they call a RHU, Reinforcement Holding Unit. They took so many men out of each battalion. And I was with the Reinforcement Holding Unit, I think it was. And we was at Hythe in Kent. And all we done, sort of general time wasting, because there wasn't much else. We was the odds and bods of all regiments. There was some from the Royal Ordnance Corps, some from the Royal Engineers. So we all had our different aspects of service life and different things of doing it, And then then D-Day came, and we didn't move, but we knew what was happening because we had been paid in. in raising money, as they call it. And we weren't allowed out of the camp whatsoever. No reason whatsoever. And then we've been to the mess hall for our midday meal. Must have been about the 9th or 10th of June anyway. And we was in a state of readiness. All our kit was packed, everything. And we was given 2 hours to move. And we very quietly just marched out the camp, marched up to the nearest railway station, which I think was called Sandin Junction in those days. And we boarded the train, and the MPs were on the station, so nobody could go absent without leave. And we went by train right into London, and then right out again. And we finished up in almost the same forest, the New Forest, just outside Southampton. Late evening. And I think it had been all organised by the Americans, because it was all American tents, and along the walkway areas there was these drinking water containers, and they looked like cow udders, a canvas container holding about 50 gallons of water, and they had about six taps so you could get a drink of water. And we had an evening meal of some, cooked meal of some description, basic. And following about 3 in the morning, we boarded 3-ton trucks and finished up down at Southampton Docks. And there we boarded a liner, it might have been a liner, but there's a fair number of troops on it anyway. And it was, I think it was known as the Lanbidi Castle. I think it was a South African line. And before we could say jackknife, we was on our way. And it took us about 4 hours to get across, I suppose. And of course, all these convoys had the barrage balloons above. And then we offshore of Normandy there, went down the landing nets, these, cargo nets. And they had a contingent of army nurses, so they were doing the sort of same thing what we were doing, going down the landing nets into these landing ships, or landing craft, infantry as they call them. And when we got to the beach, the nurses went their way and we went ours. And we eventually marched off the beach along the country lanes of Normandy, and we could see quite a lot happening, because not as much fighting, but you could see all the stores that are being stacked along the road, the fields, and piles of rations boxes, another great heap of jerry cans of petrol, another one of shells. And we finished up, we were dumped in a field overnight, and that's where we stayed for about 10 days. We was allowed to go just once, allowed to go into Bayeux, but there wasn't much to offer there. But I do remember going around the cathedral, and but to me the French, as I saw them, I mean they were just civilians waltzing around. I mean they weren't. At that time, they weren't exactly ecstatic of our arrival. And
were they hostile?
No, but they, I mean, I must admit, I didn't know their language, no more than some of them knew English. But we did get one duty one night, and that was had to go on a water carrying party. We was given a 4-gallon empty jerry can, and we had to walk 2 or 3 miles, I know, fill it up, and then walk back with it full. And that's why I never waste water now. To carry 4 gallons of water, you know you carried it. And there must have been about 10 or 12 of us, you know, detailed for that. So that was quite a lot of water being shifted, wasn't it? And then eventually, one bright evening, we were told we were going up the line. Or up the line, wasn't prepared for anything. And we were dumped in this field, and there were slit trenches there. There was other soldiers milling around. And we were told to get in a slit trench and get your head down, you know, sleep. And the following morning, I found out I'd been allocated to A Company, Rifle Company.
Of which battalion?
7th Battalion, the Hampshire Regiment. From now on, it's all the Hampshire Regiment. And some chap come up and give me a 38 radio set to carry, which was sort of a very lightweight, well, supposedly lightweight infantry radio. I suppose something about that size and about 4 inches in depth. The heaviest part of it was the solid dry battery. And while it amuses me, when you clipping this microphone on here, in those days you had them around your throat, twin mics. Anyway, all of a sudden, whether it was a RSM or a CSM called out, has that anyone been in a support company? And so I only ever volunteered twice in the army. That was one in joining as a civilian. And the second time was, I stuck my hand up and said, yes. And he said, which support regiment was you with? I said, Middlesex. Right, he said, Mortar Platoon. Because the battalion had a hammer in, you see, and they lost a lot of men. And also the Mortar Platoon, they lost some men. And I was put into the Mortar Platoon. But I must admit, I'd never seen a 3-inch mortar in my life. So we've done our basic mortar training in the front line. And I never marched any more after that. Rode everywhere in a brain carrier, right the way through.
How did you find the operation of the mortar?
Well, I was the number 4. You know, I was the one that was, you know, getting ready, getting the ammunition ready. It's a 1, 2, 3, and of course, or number 1, he was a NCO in charge who done all the setting. Number 2 put the bomb down. 3 and 4 got the ammunition ready, or even had to dig out the weapon pits. You know, when you had to dig them out. But more often than not, they was set up, you know, above ground, because sometimes, you know, I mean, you could be moving very quickly. But it was a useful move on my part. And of course, as regards, I missed out, fortunately, I missed out on the Battle of Hill 112, because that was when I became a replacement to them, you see, after their hammering. And from then on, I was in the battles of Mont Pincon, which was in Normandy.
What happened there?
Well, Mont Pincon was the beginning of the breakout. Mont Pincon is a very high point. I've seen it since the war, and it's one of the highest parts of Normandy. And I think the story went, he who holds Mont Pincon holds Normandy, because you got the view of the beachhead, the bridgehead area as we were moving forward, but also the generals could see way further, you know, towards the Seine.
What happened to you at Mont Pincon?
Nothing happened. We were just following through. I mean, what a lot of people can't understand is that although they say they talk about the infantry, there is one infantryman being supported by nine others. In other words, it's not nine infantrymen being supported by one other. When you look back, you've got the service corps, you've got the army service corps, you've got the signals, you've got the Royal Artillery, and you take nine men who's helping that one man at the front.
But were you firing your mortar?
Not Mont Pincon. We was following through. But as I was saying, you're not always slamming bombs down. It's the same as sometimes an infantryman, a man in a rifle company, is not necessarily moving forward. If he's with a battalion or brigade that is following through. So in other words, you've got two brigades forward and one following up. There's quite a lot of men in Bren carriers, on their own two feet, marching through, or sometimes they will be in three-ton trucks or TCVs, troop carrying vehicles, which was basically a three-ton truck, except that had seats down the centre and seats at each side, or forms. And, but anyway, Mont Pincon, that was the first major action. And then, of course, the next biggest one was the Battle of Falaise. And that was gruesome in as much that the sights you saw as you moved through. Now, no doubt you've heard recently of certain members of the armed forces are claiming compensation for the sights they see in the Gulf or in the Falklands. Well, the sights that I see could have been far worse than what they ever see, because when you get a large group of German soldiers in a very small area and they're being shot at by the Allied air forces, bomb blasted, and there's not much of a way out for them. And what people don't realise is, although when we see on the films of the war, you know, the German army with masses of tanks and German infantry marching across Russia, all sunburnt, a big part of the German army in the 1939-45 war they still relied upon horses. They had a lot of horse transport.